And next, I'd like to invite up to the podium our moderator for today's mayoral forum, J.W. August, managing editor for Channel 10, KGTV News, and he will be keeping a very strong arm on making sure that all of the candidates stick to their times, and that when we have our audience participation, that audience are also respectful of the time limits. J.W.?
God bless Common Cause and FOIA, trust me. It means a lot to me in my business. First, I'd like to introduce our distinguished group of panelists. We have five of them, activists in their own right around government accountability in San Diego. Albert Zivoyos, Tito to his friends, is the co-chair of the San Diego Alliance for Clean Elections. In addition to his day job as a brilliant graphics designer, he advocates for public funding of candidate campaigns to limit pay-to-play politics. Next to him is Margie Wagner. She represents Safe Democracy, an organization founded to ensure the integrity of every vote. In the fall of 2004, she helped implement a countywide election monitoring program comprised of citizen volunteers and local attorneys. Thank you, Margie, for coming. Christopher Sweeten is president of Associated Students at UCSD. He is well known for his participation in student protests of the UC Board of Regents fee increases and need for improved outreach and minority enrollment. Thank you for coming. Professor Thad Kauser is a faculty member of the UCSD Political Sciences Department. He's a one-man think tank of all manners of government reforms. His research covers publications on the initiative process, term limits, reapportionment, campaign finance laws, the blanket primary, healthcare policy, and European Parliament elections. I wonder why we haven't interviewed him on Channel 10 yet. And our final question, a distinguished question asker, is John Falke. He's the co-founder of PACE, P-A-C-E, an active member of Common Cause. Now, we have interviewed him on Channel 10. John was the lead organizer for the Defending Democracy Conference that brought together this diverse coalition of reform groups. Should we introduce them now?
I ask you to review the rules.
Oh, you want to do the rules first? Mm-hmm. Okay. First, we'll review the rules. In the first part of the Defending Democracy Mayoral Forum, we take questions from our panel. Each panelist will ask one question, and each candidate will have a minute and a half to respond, a minute 30. Our timekeeper, Simon Piaski, did I butcher it? Will flash time cards. He tells me he's got a $30 Casio that works perfectly. Had it for years. When you see the red time signs up, he's sitting up there, you must end your answer. I will rotate the order of the candidates' responses with each panelist's question to make it fair to everyone. In part two, we'll give our audience a chance to come up to the mic and ask questions, and I encourage you to do that. The mic's up here, if you see. It's on this side. In order to give as many people a chance to ask as many questions as possible, keep your questions short and direct them to a candidate, if you would. Kathy, who was just up here, will be our mic monitor, and she will give you a card to write your question on. And candidates will have up to 1 minute to respond. Finally, we'll have closing statements from each candidate. They'll have up to 2 minutes to summarize their positions and respond to any issues raised. Turn off your cell phones, please. And anything that makes noise. Now, our candidates. You can see they're all here. Starting closest to me, Mike Shelby, is a resident of Carmel Valley, a business owner of San Diego Harley-Davidson, and a Vietnam veteran. Mr. Shelby is well known for his leadership around the campaign to save the cross at the Mount Soledad Veterans Memorial. Pat Shea lives in La Jolla and a Harvard-trained businessman and lawyer. Mr. Shea was active with the San Diego Host Committee for the Republican National Convention in 1996, was chair of the San Diego Citizens Task Force on Ballpark Planning, and is active with the local Chamber of Commerce. Jerry Sanders is a resident of Kensington. He's best known as a San Diego Police Department former chief of police, where he was until 1999, capping a 26-year career with the department. He later became the CEO of the United Way of San Diego County and has been on the board of many nonprofits. Richard Ryder is a retired stockbroker and financial planner, a Vietnam vet. He is best known for his activism and litigation around cutting taxes and is the chair of the San Diego Tax Fighters. Mr. Ryder is a president of Economy Telecom, a family business brokering telecommunications services. Next to Mr. Ryder is Donna Fry, is a local business owner who hails from Claremont. She has served the city of San Diego as a council member since 2001, distinguished herself by raising concerns about the city budget and calling for audits of the San Diego pension system. Steve Francis, next to Ms. Fry, is also a business owner running the travel nurse staffing business in Carmel Valley. Before coming to San Diego, Mr. Francis served in the Nevada State Assembly in the 1980s and was elected majority leader at the age of 30. And finally, Jim Bell is an environmental designer of life-supporting, sustaining development projects. In addition to serving on Mayor Murphy's Environmental Task Force, he is also active in a wide range of environmental groups such as the San Diego Ecology Center. I think we're ready to begin. Tito, would you ask the first question, please? And Mike, you have to begin the response, Mr. Shelby.
Good evening, everybody. I'm glad to see such a great turnout. I'd like to remind you we have information about clean money and clean elections on our table in the back. We are also taking names for an initiative drive at the end of the year, beginning of next year. We want to put this initiative on the ballot for November 2006, and we can do this with your help. So please stop by and visit John Hartley down there, and he'll avail you of more information. And the question is as follows. San Diegans are increasingly concerned about the undue influence that special interests with deep pockets have on the way our government is run. With clean money elections, candidates and electeds who gather enough qualifying small contributions from voters would no longer be forced to spend time fundraising and catering to special interests, but could instead respond to constituents and the public. How will you make clean elections possible, and would you vote to support allocating public funds up to 0.5% for clean money elections?
I'll vote and I'll work to make elections more responsible, more responsive, and more about what this country is about by fighting everything you just talked about, fighting these campaign finance laws which restrict us and restrict freedom of speech. In this country, you're allowed to talk with your money. These special interests you talk about are people who care, organizations that care deeply about things, are willing to put in their dollars and cents. From Steve Francis or Pat or Rich Ryder or myself, we put on our hard-earned money into these campaigns, and companies, corporations, businesses, unions, for crying out loud, put money into campaigns because they care, because they worked hard for a long time, made that money, and they think in a democracy, in a country that's based on freedom, they've got the right to have their thoughts and their ideas heard. And I'll fight for their right and against anything you just talked about.
Mr. Shea?
Is this on?
Yes.
Do I have to sit next to Mike the whole afternoon? You know, I probably would not have been very interested in your question until I ran for mayor this time. And it's interesting when you face up to the fact that San Diego faces some very difficult situations, and all of us up here present different ideas. I come from a place where, with my background in structured finance, I bring something that nobody else does, and I'll talk about that later. But the opportunity to get my message out is obviously impaired by the fact that I don't have the money that Steve Francis does and is willing to spend, and I don't have the support of the unions, and I don't have the endorsements of my friend Jerry Sanders. And so it's up to me, like Mike and like Jim and Richard Ryder, to go out and overcome an obvious imbalance. And the problem with that is that it doesn't get my message to you like their message gets to you. I'm not sure what I would do with your initiative, but I'm a lot more sympathetic to it now than I was 60 days ago.
Well, go ahead and clap for Pat. What the heck? I appreciate Pat bringing that up. I started at the same position as Pat. I don't have a checkbook that I'm willing to write checks out of. All of my fundraising has been done on the website, or it's been done by individuals. Nobody giving more than the legal limit of $300. There's been no special interest money. There's been no independent expenditures on my part, and there won't be in the primary. And I feel very comfortable in knowing that I'm getting community support and a broad base of support. And I look at what the county has done with their ordinance, that if somebody's going to put $100,000 or more of their own money in a campaign, they have to advise the county registrar's office 30 days before or 21 days before the campaign, which takes the limits off of everybody else so that they can raise a higher amount of money up to the amount that the special interest is going to raise. So I am very comfortable raising it one person at a time and going throughout the community and getting that community support. And I think that's exactly what campaigns are supposed to be about.
I'm Richard Ryder. The siren call of public money for campaign finance is something I oppose. What we see is the idea that somehow we'll get our campaigns, the smaller candidates, we'll get our campaigns funded, but it doesn't solve the problem because the special interest money is still there. And the number one special interest money in the race that we're involved in, and for all local races, are the labor unions. And this measure, while it restricts the candidates as to what they can put in, what they can deal with if they want to qualify for the public money, it does not restrict labor unions. And they make far greater contributions to these campaigns in the form of independent expenditures. And actually, as far as I'm concerned, they should be free to do so. But why limit the candidates? Why limit us to a $300 per candidate, per contributor limitation? Is that protecting you from evil, whoever special interests that you're concerned about? No, it's not. What it's doing is it's keeping those of us who seek grassroots supports, and I do have that. I've raised over $40,000, which is not easy to do when you do it the way I do it, but we would have a lot more if we didn't have these kinds of restrictions on the one hand, but I'm not going to sell out for public financing and leave the labor unions with basically carte blanche running the city of San Diego. Thank you.
I think it's very interesting that we keep talking about the labor unions as being the cause of all the problems in the city of San Diego as far as raising special interest money. I would ask my colleagues to go down to the city clerk's office and actually see who contributes to campaigns in independent expenditures before they continue to make such remarks, because it's not accurate. So just for the record. And yes, I do support the public financing of campaigns, and I'll tell you why. A lot of the issue has to do with perception. And when people perceive something to be so, it oftentimes is. I know that there have been other states that have enacted clean campaign ordinances and public financing, and it's worked quite well. And when people have pledged to do that, what we find is people who would not ordinarily be able to run and win in an election oftentimes find themselves able to compete and compete effectively and actually be able to participate in the elective process.
I'm a big believer in the First Amendment and freedom of speech. And I know I've been criticized by many about putting a large amount of money into my own race. But I view it as a way for me, as somebody from the outside, who really nobody knew before, to have my voice heard and to talk about the issues that are important to me. And I think by doing so, I think that I've contributed, win or lose, I think I've contributed to sharpening the debate and bringing out what's wrong with this city government and how they have been controlled by the labor unions. When we talk about what's fair and what's unfair, I think what's unfair is for the labor unions to take dues from members and then to take those dues and use it for political purposes and spend it however they want with no limitations. I call that taxation without representation. And I just think it's very important that people have an opportunity to be able to speak and get their opinions out. And I think that's what I'm doing. I'm proud of that. The fact that I have my thoughts to the public. People can support me. They don't have to support me. But I feel like I've been heard. And I think at the end of this campaign, I have been heard. And however it ends up, you know, I'll feel satisfied at the results. Thank you.
I'm Jim Bell, and in the past races, I was the only candidate that came out in favor of the clean election campaign. I feel that the other candidates haven't really read the measure because it doesn't limit people from putting money into it. They can put all the money in they want. They just can't take public money if they do. It limits public money to it. To a relatively modest amount compared to what other amounts of money being spent in the campaign, but it gives people like me a chance to actually run a campaign. Like last time I ran for mayor, I only raised $6,000. I don't know a lot of wealthy people, but I got just under 19,000 votes and 7.6% of the vote. Got one piece of literature to maybe 10% of the people who in the city. So I think my message is being heard by the people that get to hear it, and if there was clean election campaign, I would have the money. Even if I had $60,000 instead of only $6,000, I think I would be able to run a very effective campaign.
Thank you. Marjorie from SAVE is next, and Mr. Shea begins the answers, and we move the same direction again, if we could, please.
Okay. Hello. Can you hear me all right?
Try this
now. Can you hear me? Okay. I actually have a nonpartisan, I believe, question to ask. San Diego has recently experienced serious problems with its voting machines, election administration, and vote tabulation. For example, according to reports on San Diego elections, one being from the Federal Election Assistance Commission, the Diebold machines that we have used and do use have had failure rates of 30 to 50% in the last two elections. The software we use to count our votes is observable only by the manufacturer, Diebold. What will you do to get transparent voting systems that the public can trust? Thank you.
Was that for the question or the answer? transparent elections, you know, that's a great question because The last election we had was done on a paper ballot, and we didn't count all those votes either. So it sort of depends on your perspective, I guess. You know, everyone on this stage, I think, is committed to transparent elections. It is a destructive part of our character as a community and as a democracy if we are unable to rely upon the results of our voting practices. The Diebold machines are unreliable, at least at this point. They need to be proven to be reliable before we get into another close election. I think we need to stay with tested procedures, probably paper ballots, assuming we can count all the votes on the paper ballots, Donna, next time.
Maybe.
And we need to do that until we can come up with a reliable way of doing it mechanically. But to do it otherwise, I mean, it is terribly destructive to democracy to have a substantial number of people believe that their vote didn't matter, that the election wasn't correctly counted, because it alienates them, not just from the election that they had, but from the next one. That's not good for democracy.
I think it's a training issue, isn't it, Donna?
Nope.
You know, I think one of the things that may be hurting us, and there's obviously a few issues involved in this, is number one, we have become very impatient with having to wait more than an hour or two to get the results of an election. We either want it projected so that we get it in about an hour and a half after the polls close. Sometimes we're happy if the polls haven't even closed and we want a projection. And I just don't think that you can hurry this. This is the most important thing we do in a democracy, which is to vote. And I don't have any problem with paper ballots where we have an actual fixed record of those. It may take longer to count them. It may take longer to get results. We may have to wait a little bit longer, and we don't get the instant gratification of knowing exactly where we're at all the time, so you don't know until the next morning. But I think that's pretty important in a democratic process like this. If we do to go to electronic voting machines, I think the registrar needs to have a copy of all that. You can't leave that up to the manufacturer of the machine to have the only copy of that. That seems a little ridiculous to leave that open to manipulation to one person who produces a product.
It is important that we have confidence in whatever voting procedure we use so that people are comfortable when they go to the polls that their vote counts. I'd like to approach this from an entirely different way than the way we do it now. I look to Oregon. For years now, Oregon has done a mail ballot. It has worked quite well, and there's been very few complaints. We don't have to rely on the mechanical machines. People understand mail ballots. They've got lots of time to vote. The voting turnout is very high with mail ballots. And that's the approach I'd like to see us start looking at. This election should have been a mail ballot vote. There are two issues on the ballot. We could have saved a fortune, well over $1 million, if we had done this as a mail ballot. But I would expand that to the broader idea of rethinking how we go about balloting and return to the take a look at Oregon, and if it works for us, let's pursue the idea of doing mail ballots. Thank you.
It's interesting, the last election, one of the things that I learned that, I'm paraphrasing someone, but it's not the voting, it's the counting. And I learned that lesson well, and I think a lot of voters did who felt extremely disenfranchised. With the Diebold machines, there first of all needs to be a paper trail. With the electronic voting machines, if you recall, there was no paper trail and they were easily manipulated. And I believe it was Bev Harris who was had exposed these machines, and in fact had gone before and provided testimony to show that essentially a monkey could rig those machines and get a different result. So that's how unreliable they were. So we need to have access to the computer codes to understand how easy it is to manipulate them, even if you have a paper trail. The other thing we need to do is ensure that there's a higher percentage of hand counting, so actual someone verifying that to make sure that the tallies of the ballots actually meet the tallies that are coming out of the machines, because what has been found is that is not often the case to ensure the accuracy.
I have no problem using a paper ballot. I think that, you know, the most important thing is that people have confidence in the election. And the problem with these electronic machines are when there's somebody in some corporate office that is only knows how the software works, is that once there's a problem, and people think that there's fraud involved or there wasn't counted accurately, then it's done in, and you're going to disenfranchise the voters. So I have no problem with it. If we go that route or we continue to go that route, we have to be able to have a paper backup. That's the only way to do this, so that if there's a problem, we can go back and we can check it. And without that, then I think that you're really running a very high risk of turning the voters off to an election. So I think it's very important that, again, if we go down that route, that we have a paper ballot to back it up. Some sort of system. And until we can reach that point, then I don't think we should be using these electronic devices until that could be proven that we can do that. So that's where I stand on that. And I really don't believe in mail by vote. I think that is really open yourself up to fraud. You think we had problems this last election. Wait till you go down a path of voting by mail. Okay, and then all sorts of fraud and all sorts of improprieties are going to come up. And this will be in the courts forever. So I think the good old-fashioned way you go down and you vote is the way to go about it.
Yep. I think paper ballot's the only reliable system we have right now, and that's what we should use. I think everybody else has said pretty much what I would say. It's, if you don't feel sure your ballot counts, why vote?
I think San Diego has a lot of issues. These voting machines are going to get fixed. I think that if the Bolt system isn't working, it's got to work, obviously. And it's a mechanical situation that's got to be handled. But, you know, everybody loves Donna and should. I mean, you're courageous and brave, and that's a wonderful thing. You've overcome a lot of adversity. But I don't think that last election was a problem. Those people that didn't fill in the circle, that just didn't count. They were instructed to, and they didn't follow instructions. There was nothing wrong, and if there's any inference of corruption or anything, that's wrong too. We've got to take a cloud away from this. Ever since the election of 2000 and the hanging chads, nobody's happy with the way things are going. That's because the losers just keep on whining. Let's just be happy with the country that we have. We have a free country where we can have elections and
come on,
fix
hey,
the machinery so we can go forward.
Let them speak, please.
And stop complaining about it.
Thank you. Mr. Sweetan, UCSD Associate President of the Students, would you please address your question to Mr. Sanders first?
Yes. San Diego has a diverse voting population, but there's still low participation from some, particularly from youth, new citizens who don't speak English well, and people with disabilities. Some would speculate that it's because their issues are not being addressed or that they don't feel like they're a part of the process. What are you doing to outreach to these traditionally disenfranchised groups and make sure they have access to the ballot?
That's obviously a large issue right now, and I don't want to dismiss any one group, but I think it's especially difficult for a group of folks like us to reach youth. I think youth understand youth best, and right now some of these elections don't have a real resonance because of the fact that it's mostly older candidates, and I think that it's absolutely critical that we start outreaching that way. One of the ways we've tried to outreach into the youth community is by more of an internet strategy, by using the internet for some of our advertising, for sending out email letters, for really trying to use a medium that the youth use. In terms of reaching out to diverse communities, we have several people in the Somali community. We have people in each of the ethnic communities that are working on the campaign, getting our signs out, that are talking to people in native languages, encouraging them to vote if they're citizens, and also getting voter registration information out to people who may not have voted. I've also been at supermarkets in every community in the city where we take voter registration information, also take information about what we do, and we know that almost everybody in the city shops at a supermarket at some point.
We've pursued the more traditional ways of reaching out, which, of course, is to use English. We think that's the language that we should be using. To the extent that we could reach out to certain communities through other languages, that would be great. But in my opinion, when you vote in America, you should use the English ballot. But that's why I like the mail ballot, because you can get it in advance, not walk into a booth, not know what you're doing. You have a chance to make decisions long before you actually vote. You can seek other people's advice that you are comfortable with. You can seek other people who better understand the language. Those are options all that I think we should offer. And that's why I like the mail ballot. I think it opens up far more opportunities for participation. We're having trouble getting, particularly the youth, it's always been the case, getting the youth to come and vote. They seem to have better things to do. That damn beach over there is a major distraction. And so to solve that problem, give them a ballot, give them the time to decide when they want to vote, where they want to vote, and get away from this idea that we have to go off to some little booth someplace during a specific day at a specific time. That's no good. That's not the way to vote. We can expand our voting. Every experience we've had with mail balloting, we had a record turnout when we did the mail ballot in San Diego for the convention center. They thought it was going to be a low turnout. It turned out to be a 62% turnout for a special election, and that was the only thing on the ballot. It works. It's been working in Oregon. There hasn't been a fraud problem. They love it up there. We should adopt the same system. Thank you.
Some of the ways my campaign has been working to make sure that we involve all members of the community is we go out into the communities, and we go out in mass into the communities, and we walk, and we knock on doors, and we make phone calls, and we go to community forums, and we make our presence felt so that people know that we are interested. We have been to all 8 districts. We're out there on a regular basis as far as making sure that we can get our message out to again, all members of the community. We produce our campaign materials in other languages. We also have staff members who are bilingual. We, again, attend forums. We go to college campuses. Right now it's just summer school, so we haven't been as active on the campuses. But we have many people that are working on our campaign that are from the college campuses, including this campus, that help us with that. As far as for seniors and people with disabilities, we will make sure that as much information is available. If people need access to the polls or they need help, we will try and hook them up with someone that can provide transportation, provide the information, and just make sure that the people who want to vote have access to our campaign. And even some of the folks that maybe think they don't want to vote, I send my husband Skip out into the ocean, and he gets that's where the young people
those
are.
Those waterlogged boats.
Yeah. Get those salty surfers.
Well, I turned 50 this year. And I have to say, I'm the youngster of the group here. So please don't use my youth and inexperience against me, please. quote a Reagan phrase. I think this whole campaign has been, not only for myself, but I think for all the candidates that are up here, has been one where we have really all tried to reach out to everybody. we all know each other pretty well by now. And the reason we know each other so well is that we continue to come to forums like today. And I can tell you, we've been at forums all over this community, talking and meeting with people, telling them our viewpoints. So I have to compliment, I think, my colleagues here. I think we've all tried very hard to get out there. We, in my campaign, we certainly are reaching out. We're doing a lot of email kinds of things for the younger people. We're reaching out to the different types of communities. Tonight, for example, I'm going to be at a Spanish television station. I have to bring a translator with me, trying to get out to the Latino community. And I know there's an event tonight out in the, southeast San Diego to get out to those communities out there. So we're all trying hard, I think, and I think it's important. I think it's very important during a campaign that all the candidates work their hardest to communicate their viewpoints and to get out to supermarkets, to get out of forums, to do walks, to get out in the community. And I think we're all doing as much as we can right now in the short time frame this campaign has allowed us.
Yeah, it's it's very important that we involve everybody in democracy. That's one of the problems now is people are feeling more and more that they're being pushed aside and not being involved. I've been doing what I've been doing for the past 10 or 20 years, and that's going out to campuses and giving talks on how to create life support sustaining economies. That's been my inroads to the youth community, whether it's Southwestern College or here. Recently gave a lecture here for a class on campus. And this election and really everything is about the youth. I mean, I'm 63 years old. If I last another 20 years, I'll feel pretty good about it, have a pretty good ride. But this is really about the young people and future generations. And I think I'm the only candidate that's bringing that message to the table, and I'll talk a little bit more about that in a few minutes.
We talk about handicap, and we talk about language. Well, I don't see anybody signing up here, and they think they should be, because if anything, people who are hearing impaired deserve to have somebody signing for them. We do it at all the events that I have with the Bay of California, but I think we've come a long way with the ADA laws. They've been taken advantage of by lawyers and activists, but they're important laws, and once we get past all the tort reform things we have to, then maybe we can get to where we really want to take care of people who are handicapped and need help. And that's important. Diversity, look, I grew up in the projects of Brooklyn, New York. I don't care what color a person is. I don't care if they're Puerto Rican or Hungarian or Polish. We live in areas because we can only afford to live in certain areas. I want to get down to where the gang members are. I want to get down to southeast San Diego, let those people know that there's hope. There's people who care about them. There's people who care about them because they live in poor neighborhoods. I want them to know there's opportunity in America, and if they work hard, study, do whatever they have to do, learn how to speak English, and don't let anybody convince them they can get by without learning how to speak English in the United States of America, that they can make a success of their lives. Running for mayor, being mayor, it's important for me to get out because that's where I grew up, in those kind of neighborhoods, and I want to go out there and let those people know that people who have these kind of opportunities to run for these kind of offices, which it's a privilege to be up here, care about them.
Yeah, the question is, how do we reach out and engage people, whether they are disenfranchised or not? You know, the biggest issue on disenfranchisement and distance between the voters, the electorate, and government is the fact that, at least at the city level, most of us don't trust our government anymore. We have no reason to trust our government. They have misbehaved terribly. And one of the ways that we can reach out, especially in a short election like this, 60 days, is to be honest and to bring a message that is truthful and not political. And some of you know that the message I bring is that the city of San Diego has a structural finance problem that is catastrophic, and that there is a process that you can go through called a Chapter 9 reorganization which allows you to deal with all of your problems in one place at one time. And it's not a very political message. It's not a message that most people want to hear. But it is the way out. And it's been done before, and it's done successfully, and communities do get back to providing services. And what I've found in my race for mayor is that people respond if they believe you're being honest with them. And they will be engaged, and they will come up, and they will tell you they don't like your message, but they like you, and they believe in you, and they believe that you bring something important to the process. And if you do that, people will engage, and they will meet you halfway.
Thank you. Professor, your question is to Mr. Ryder.
Great, Mr. Ryder. Cities such as Los Angeles and San Francisco have created strong sunshine laws and ethics commissions. What steps would you take to ensure that government in San Diego is transparent and accountable, including but not limited to a fiscally sound, balanced budget?
Well, it starts with a budget that is comprehensible, of course, with the one we have right now. No one understands. Donald readily admits she doesn't understand it, and she's down there looking at it full time. I don't understand it, and I'm supposed to be an expert in this. It should be something that is understandable by an average person who can sit down and grasp what it costs to deliver services. As far as sunshine laws, we've gone through a period of secrecy in our city, which really shames us. It goes beyond anything that we could have justified. Some terrible things happen behind closed doors. We are, fortunately, I think we're past that. I think we've moved on to the idea of open government. It's kind of funny because Donna always talks about open government. It's sad that she even has to mention it. We shouldn't even have to discuss that. It should be so obvious that that should be what government does. There shouldn't be closed meetings. There are a few litigation cases where you need closed doors, but otherwise we should open it up. One of the things I'd really like to see, city council meetings are very hard to get to. They're held during the day, downtown, expensive, hard to get to. Working people can't make it. We need to shift to evening meetings, move them around to different locations where people can attend, where people can actually voice their opinions, and we can hear more from the citizens and from the grassroots. There's no easy answers because we've gone down a very dark path, but the only way we're going to bring this city back under control is open, fully approachable government, which up to now we haven't seen, but I think regardless of who gets elected up here, we're about to see. Thank you.
When I first ran for city council in 2001, I remember on my campaign literature, I had community right to know and open government, and no one knew what I was talking about. And I said, don't worry, you will. And I believe you do, because that's what everybody's talking about. It absolutely is an important issue. So one of the things that we've already done and will continue pushing in this direction is to make sure that closed sessions are the exception and not the rule, and we're certainly getting better. And in order to accommodate and to accomplish this, I had to boycott closed sessions. We had to go through and change the permanent rules of council. We managed to get Proposition D on the ballot last November, which required the government to actually release to you, the public, the documents that you're supposed to have, as well as establish a government efficiency and openness committee. We can do a whole lot more, and that includes making sure that the documents that the public needs in order to participate are provided in a timely manner. And as far as dealing with the budget, to make it a lot easier to understand, we'd require and direct the city auditor comptroller to provide monthly revenue and expense reports for each city department as required under the city charter in a public hearing at night. So working people are on the weekend, so the actual people that work, it would be convenient for you, it would be in your neighborhoods, and then you would understand where the money's going and how the budget works or doesn't work.
One of the things about my campaign that I keep talking about over and over again is to bring business principles to running City Hall. It's something that needs to be done in order to wring out the inefficiencies in the systems. But one of the things that I believe that we can do also in the corporate world, I've been the just until very recently running a public company, NYSE company, for the last 3.5 years. And public companies, and now charities are also falling under this, have something called Sarbanes-Oxley, which is the law that came out of the Enron scandal. You know, there was a conviction, I think it was just yesterday, of Bernie Ebers with WorldCom, or he was sentenced, rather, 25 years. These kinds of things are coming out of these scandals. So the federal government did something called Sarbanes-Oxley, which is it's giving public companies a scrutiny that they've never had. And then you have to set the tone at the top with these public companies now, and you have to make sure it's very clear to everybody what that tone is of honesty, integrity, ethic, financial transparency, you know, accounting. And you have to do that. You have to prove it. Every day you have to prove that you're doing that. And I think taking that law, the Sarbanes-Oxley law, and applying it to city government would actually be a very, very good thing for San Diego. And I plan to do that if I'm mayor of San Diego.
I'm going to have to leave you. I'm going to be interviewed on KUSI for a show this Sunday at 4 o'clock, so I'm going to have to shoot across town to get over there. I think the best way to shine light on what's been happening is Chapter 9 bankruptcy for the city. And I'll let Pat talk about that more a little bit later. I suspect there's going to be scandals going back to Pete Wilson and maybe even before that are going to be uncovered if we do that. We need a complete clearing the decks on this. I want to let you know that I have copies of my new book out back. The book just sort of came out just when this election was called. It's called Creating a Sustainable Economy and Future on Our Planet, San Diego, Tijuana Region, a Case Study. And it's an actual economic plan to make our city and region renewable energy, water, and food self-sufficient, and land use planning that's consistent with that goal. It's also free on my website, www.jimbell.com. Anybody can read it online or print out free copies, as many as you want. So let other people know about it. Check it out. There's quite a bit of nuts and bolts in here. But we have this wonderful potential to create a sustainable economy here and ultimately for the whole world. And that's what we're going to have to do if we're going to survive very long on this planet. Thank you very much.
Thank you for coming, Mr. Bell.
Is it my turn?
Yes, sir.
Okay. You guys are going to have to elect ethical candidates to office. It's important. That's why it's important that this youth get engaged. I think it's, you know, it goes back to the other question, but in America, the youth just doesn't vote. And that's a fact, and it's sad. You know, on college campuses, as a Vietnam vet, I was shunned on college campuses. I mean, I was talked down to and kicked around, and there were tirades against me. That's my feeling when I come on college campuses now. It's like a hostile environment 37 years later. And I don't think a lot has changed to engage the students, to give them hope, to give them a reason to vote. I don't think we need new laws. I'd like to think that we're going to look to ethical candidates and vote for them and work for them, and people are going to come up here and lie and mislead you and tell you what you want to hear or what they think that the polls say. Polls will influence people in ways that you know, you talk about something that's wrong. Take a look at how these polls stop the momentum of some campaigns and get other campaigns going. This is what the media is doing. People got to be smart enough to read, get through this stuff, and see who the candidates are, who they really are. And that's up to you guys, and that's why these forums are so important. And I salute you all for being here. And let's make them worthwhile by going out and getting more kids in here, more of these college kids, and letting them know how important it is. This election has been focused on in a great way. I think it's really important.
Yeah, I think the question was transparency, sunshine laws. How do we bring ethics back into government? Sometimes you lose the question in the answer. Sometimes the answers are better than the question. But Mike's got a good point, and that is, you know, it's very hard to legislate courage and good judgment and proper behavior. Leadership, doing the right thing when it's inconvenient. And to the extent that we try to do that, we usually do a pretty bad job of it. We have an ethics commission here in San Diego. I'm not telling you that I'm terribly satisfied with what they've chosen to get involved with and the results of their efforts. This is really about choosing good people to run for office. It's more about encouraging good people to run for office than choosing the right people. And Mike's right. A lot of it has to do with you. It has to do with people that have a skin in the game, who care about government, actually reading this and reading the newspapers and coming to these forums and deciding, what type of person do you need to fill a political office at a critical moment? And then having the courage to stand up and say so, not just to yourself, but the people you know, talk to, and go out and vote, and don't be tolerant of people that are rascals. We have rascals all over the city of San Diego in public office. Don't be tolerant of that stuff anymore. Thank you.
You know, I've been to my share of city council meetings, and I have to tell you that I'm pretty put off by them. Not only do you have to go down and find a place to park and probably pay 10 or 15 bucks, then you got to go through a metal detector. Then you go up 12 floors to a chamber where the council members tower over you and look kind of down on you, and they wander around and get candy bars and coffee, and they talk on the phone while you're talking to them, if you get the opportunity to talk to them, because there's not really any set agenda. There's an agenda, but it's moved around so that if there are a lot of people there, frequently they've got to wait for 4 or 5 or 6 or 7 hours, depending on the issue, and nobody can sit down in city council chambers for 6 hours to discuss an issue, and when the crowd leaves, then the discussion goes on. There's no reason council chambers couldn't be in Balboa Park, in one of the buildings where you have comfortable seating. You could arrange that. You could have free parking. You don't need a metal detector at the door. I think that shows great distrust in the people who come to watch those proceedings. I also think open government is more than just a slogan. If you'll look on Chapter 6 of my fiscal recovery plan on my website, jerrysandersformayor.com, I talk about each step a mayor needs to do with all the staff in the city of San Diego, all the lobbyists, all of the people who are put in on staff. They need to sign an ethical pledge. They need to be trained in it. It has to go much farther than simply saying, let's have open and honest government. I mean, that's a slogan everybody can say.
Thank you. John Falke of Pace has the last question from our panel, and that's to be directed to Ms. Fry.
Just want to make sure this is on. Yes,
it is.
And as the last question here, I want to say we're very proud to be up here with you today. This wonderful audience of students, faculty, people from the community. We're also proud of the fact that the Registrar of Voters is in the back for anybody that's not registered yet or anybody that'd like to poll watch during the next election. My question is for you, I think, first, Steve Francis.
Actually.
Our city's financial relationship to San Diego's redevelopment agencies needs to be reexamined, particularly in the light of recent cases such as public monies used for the development of Petco Public Park, the ballpark. How would you ensure that redevelopment monies are used for the public good, to benefit the majority of San Diego residents, rather than lining the pockets of the few?
I think we should.
Oh, maybe that goes for Ms. Fry?
I'll be happy to answer that. One of the issues that has bothered me for a very long time has been the abuse of redevelopment. I think there are times when it works very well, and I think it can work very well. But in the city of San Diego, sometimes it has not. And I'll give you a perfect example of when the redevelopment agencies, which owe the city of San Diego today over $220 million, the city has loaned to the redevelopment agencies. And when we asked to get some of that money paid back, we were unable to do so. So one of the first things I would do, well, you need 5 votes of the council, and 5 votes of the council weren't there. So one of the first things I would do as mayor to make sure that it was not being abused and that the public benefit was actually being served in the public interest is I would go out into the communities, and every single community that I need to go out to and tell you this story so that you know what's going on with money that was loaned by you to the redevelopment agencies that we need now so we can get it paid back. That is the easiest way, is to educate the public about what's going on, go out in the communities, and then have the citizens get involved, show up at City Hall, and make your voices heard. And that changes things, and that's the easiest, fastest way to do it.
I think there's a couple things. Donna keeps talking about this money that's owed to the city, but what she's not saying is that a lot of that money is subordinate to bonds that have been issued for this development. And so there are laws around this, and it's not quite that easy. And I know it makes good rhetoric, but it's just not really the facts. The second thing is as far as to make sure that we're not lining the pockets of a few. I'm not sure that was a question. It seemed like that was more of a statement. But nonetheless, I think this eminent domain, the power of eminent domain, is a very important issue, and I think it's something we all have to be very, very concerned about, especially with the recent Supreme Court ruling. And when you're closing businesses down, like there was one closed down, I think it was in Donna's district recently, a good thriving business, so that they can build a hotel. Okay, I just think that's wrong. The only time that you should be using these powers of eminent domain is if it's a blighted community, and it has to be proven that it's not a blighted community in order to do that, or to prove it is a blighted community in order to do that. So I think that we have to be very, very careful as city elected officials that we don't abuse that power, because it's already been passed by the Supreme Court, and we can talk about passing some city laws around that. The fact of the matter is that when you're an elected official, you've been given power, you have to exercise that very carefully and very thoughtfully. And you want to make sure that when you're electing people, that you're electing honest people, people with integrity, and people who are going to exercise that power very carefully.
Megan?
Elect ethical people. Be engaged. Do what you're doing and do it more. Do it more often. You know, I love Donna too, but Donna, we can go up there and protest all we want. When that money was taken out of the pension fund, which is where this whole thing began to spin out of control, and it was used to pay off the Republican convention and the ballpark and God knows what else, the money was sitting there. We didn't know, citizens didn't know, we couldn't go up there and protest because it was done in an underhanded way and that you'd never find out about until, 8, 9, 10 years later. So if we don't have ethical people up there, in who have this trust, the money is in trust. It was pension money, for crying out loud. Who ever authorized someone taking $156 million and using it for other needs other than what it was designed for? You know what? You can have laws, you can pass everything you want, but unless you elect ethical people, open government, transparency, let's have open forums, let's do all these kind of things, let's have talk radio shows so the mayor can talk to everybody every week and hear the questions up and back. Let's do it all. Let's keep it transparent. Let's keep it as open as we can. But unless the rascals will be in there, as soon as we let them in there, if we don't keep our eye on the ball, we've got to make sure the people that we elect are ethical and keep them
keep them so that we know we hold their feet to the fire. We don't need more laws, boy. We need more honest politicians.
Yeah, you know, the question which goes to the use of redevelopment money and the use of all of our money for all of the public purposes that we want it to go for really belies the bigger question, which is how we spend our money, the process that we use to address basic public services, which we don't do very well at the city of San Diego. The redevelopment districts downtown have been very successful, and they have a substantial amount of money. And I appreciate Donna wanting to bring some of that money back in a time of crisis, and that may very well be appropriate, but it doesn't fix the problem. The fact is that the city of San Diego needs to be able to operate within its own budget, and it hasn't for a long time, and we've created artificial financial statements in order to try and fake our way through it. The redevelopment agency does a pretty good job spending its money. I was the chairman of the convention center, and the city wanted to pull back the money from the convention center, and I wouldn't let the mayor do it because we spent our money better than the mayor would spend our money. And the real issue that the real message we want to send back to people in City Hall is, do your job, spend the money that we give you, the tax dollars we give you, ethically and appropriately. And then you won't need to come and take the redevelopment money and the convention center money and the other money to backfill your problems. I agree with Mike. I mean, this is really about fundamental economic structures, and it starts with City Hall. And the focus of organizations like this is to hold City Hall to a very high standard.
You know, I think it's only fair that after Donna being on Roger Hedgecock yesterday and taking the slings and arrows that somebody wrote a question just for her. I couldn't disagree more about redevelopment downtown. $5.6 billion in investment in the downtown area. For every dollar that's put in, $5 are leveraged. 11,500 units of housing that other people in San Diego have not been willing to take. 8,000 hotel rooms, 56,000 jobs. A vibrant community center. I really think that great cities have great downtowns, and I think that's exactly what's happened. We know what the schedule for repayment is. It starts in 2020, and we'll get back $250 million from all that that's going to be paid back. We've also gotten $433 million in sales tax and property tax increment that's come out of that investment. That's the best investment we've made in San Diego so far. Let's look at other areas in San Diego where we can start redevelopment areas, where we can capture up to 80 or 90% of the property tax and sales tax and all that, so it doesn't go back to the state, and instead we can redevelop an area and create that type of investment all over San Diego. That's what's absolutely critical. It's not asking them to pay back early so that the city can balance a budget that's so badly out of whack because the spending's out of whack. You don't take money from that where you lose that leveraging so that you can spend more in a budget that hasn't been honest to start with.
Here's one where Jerry and I do not agree. Redevelopment agencies are extremely dangerous. For one thing, as Jerry indicated, they claim all development that occurs within their boundaries is the result of the redevelopment district. Nonsense. There's all kinds of development that occurs in areas that are not in redevelopment districts, and that's just fine. It's a canard that this is somehow some leveraging of dollars. Nothing would have happened otherwise. It would be a stagnant community for 20 years. That's simply not the case. But the issue is more fundamental. We touched on it just in passing. We have gone to the standard that the government can confiscate anybody's property. We're used to thinking of this as commercial property, but we're now starting to move into redevelopment districts in residential neighborhoods. The government can come in and take anybody's property under the new federal standard, essentially if they feel they can make more money through another person owning that property and somehow generating more revenue. This is a scary, scary concept. Mike recommends you elect ethical people. Great. who's running as an unethical candidate? How do you tell? Don't trust us. We're not the people you need to trust. If I'm mayor, we're going to change the city charter to restrict such eminent domain confiscations only to public use. I fought these ballparks and stadiums for years. The era of big sports subsidies is over, and it's time that we limit eminent domain to what it was originally intended for, public use only. Thank you.
Thank you, panel, for your questions. Now the candidates, we're going to hold their feet to the fire. We're going to ask the audience to come up to the mic there and ask questions. Please direct it towards one candidate, and the candidate has a minute to respond. If any of the other candidates want to also respond, just give me a hands up or something like this, and we'll make sure you get a chance to get a shot in.
You'll see a lot of hands.
Good afternoon. My name is Laura Quinn, and I'm the president of the Graduate Student Association. So I'm basically Mr. Sweeten's counterpart for the graduate and professional students at UCSD. My question is for Councilman Fry. A recent report suggests that San Diego is behind schedule implementing the Strong Mayor Initiative. As a member of the City Council, what can you tell us about the process of implementation? And as a mayoral candidate, how do you expect this process to affect the next term of office?
I'm glad you asked that. And just so you know, one of the things that has been happening is pretty much on a weekly basis, the City Council has been meeting to discuss the City Council's role in the Strong Mayor form of governance and how that might change. And we also, as a result of my Government Efficiency and Openness Committee, were able to form a Citizens Advisory Committee, which would not have been done otherwise. And in, Norma Damachek, I'm not sure if you know her, she chairs that. So we do have a Citizens Advisory Committee. The other thing that I've done, and in fact I just announced that today, is that rather than waiting for the mayor, who has resigned, to take action, I announced a plan today to form the mayoral legislative structure or the executive structure of what a strong mayor form of government would look like. And my time's up, otherwise I'll go into the rest of the details.
Thank you. Oh, what? One moment. Go ahead, sir.
Just a quick comment. There's an interesting problem in the strange bedfellows that we have up here. After this election is over, the primary, no one's going to win. They're going to be a first place and a second place finisher. And I'm hoping that whatever that those two remaining people are, that they pull together and go down and present to the City Council a plan that hopefully can keep the City Council from stealing all the powers of the new strong mayor. This will be very important because this process is very badly timed. Our election is not going to work well in that regard. There's supposed to be a mayor in there representing the mayor's side of this, and we don't have that right now. This is a big danger, and I think all of us will be looking forward to cooperating with each other if that is the case, and we can step forward before the November runoff and try to help shape this policy. I think that's very important.
Well, last response, Mr. Saunders.
Well, I think everybody needs to be concerned about this. An ordinance has to go before the council by November 18th so you can get the second reading in before the end of the year. Maybe the council's met a few times. I know the first time I went, Donna was there, two council members were there, myself, my staff, and Norma. They couldn't even get a quorum. I understand they've only met a few times, and I have to tell you, I am really concerned about this. The mayor has opted out entirely. We've had a couple of brief reports from different consultants which basically say hire new consultants to do this. This issue is not being addressed by council. It's not being addressed by anybody. And we need to have an answer on the table because if there's a runoff election, there will not be a mayor in office before that ordinance has to go forward. So you've got the council forwarding their own ordinance.
Thank you. Ma'am?
My question is to Pat Shea. I would like to know how you feel about outsourcing current city employee jobs.
The question is how I feel about outsourcing current city employee jobs. There are some jobs that you can't, and I wouldn't support outsourcing. The safety employees, fire, police, and other safety areas, I would not be in favor of. There are other jobs that we can look at. We actually outsource some of our sewer, some of our water jobs right now. We allow public employees to compete for those jobs. There's certainly a process that we can bring to make that more efficient and more effective for us. But let me just say this. Outsourcing jobs from the city of San Diego is not going to even begin to come close to solving our financial problems. Anybody who thinks that that is the panacea, we're going to be able to cut people to the extent that we can come up with enough to backfill the pension obligation, forget it. It's not happening there. We can do it in a responsible fashion, but it's not the answer to our problems.
Mr. Francis.
Pat Shea and I differ on this as far as is the bankruptcy option. I think he's on one side of the spectrum. He's on one side of the spectrum, on the other side of the spectrum. And if you look at the problem through the eyes of a bankruptcy attorney, that's how you solve the problem. It's all on what your perspective is. And I know that we can get out of this mess without filing bankruptcy. And I just want to make sure that everyone understands that is not the option for this city, and we shouldn't go down that path. You don't take on the mayor's job by throwing in the towel. As far as outsourcing is concerned, things that I've talked about is downsizing the city government by 8 to 10%. And if I'm elected mayor, I'm also going to immediately be seeking a charter change so that we can outsource. And the reason is that you can do it cheaper if you outsource, and if you can't, or at least let the city compete with the private sector. Because by doing so, the city departments are going to become more efficient, they're going to do it at a lower cost, and competition is good, it's not bad. And we should let the city departments compete with the private sector so that they can be more efficient. And if they can't win it that way, then they shouldn't be able to do it.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Francis.
I think if you recall, union employees are a lot happier employees than non-union employees, and it's something you might want to think about.
Ms. Fry, last response.
Well, just a quick comment, because I do have a differing opinion here. The outsourcing, and again, these are good sound bites for some of my colleagues here, but that's really all they are. The goal should be to deliver high-quality services to the public in a cost-effective manner. And now that we're transitioning to a strong mayor form of government, we have the opportunity to do a thorough top-to-bottom management and review process. And then after that analysis and after we complete that, rather than creating more bureaucracies, because that's what we have to do to manage the contracts and to manage the outside contractors, we can actually focus our energies on re-engineering and retooling our city government to be the most effective and most efficient in the state. And government can do that if they have the right leader.
One more.
I'm sorry, just real quick.
One more.
Union employees aren't the happier employees than employees who are non-union. That's ridiculous. Employees who work for good leadership and good bosses in a good environment are happier than employees who aren't. Unions aren't any better than non-unions, and vice versa. It's just a matter of your leadership. So let's not make this a union bashing thing or a union celebration. We're trying to fix the city.
Ma'am?
Good afternoon. My name is Dorothea Stewart, and I'm a staff employee here in the library. And this afternoon, we've had several questions that have stemmed around democracy and elections. And I, too, am very interested in democracy, and I'm very interested in outreach. And my proposal is that we totally flip our electoral system on end and hold elections on Saturday and Sunday, thereby just increasing the availability of everyone. And even though we do have laws that permit people to perhaps come in late or come to work early. I'd like to get the initial reaction from Councilperson Fry to see what she thinks about that. And I haven't checked the charter, so I don't know if we can actually do that. But I really, really do think that this is one way to make our to level our electoral process and truly make voting available for everyone.
No, and I certainly appreciate your point, but one of the things that just so you're aware of, today, all this week you can vote, the registrar voters is open, and they're also open on weekends. And so do I think we could actually change the election day to a weekend, and would we actually get more people voting? If there were evidence to show that, I'd certainly be interested in pursuing
that. A lot of international countries do that. The registrar's office is up in Claremont. How available is that? The trolley doesn't go there. Not everyone has their own personal transportation, and we should be getting away from that anyway.
And again, I understand your point, and if there were a way to make it so that, because there's also a lot of people that work on Saturday and Sundays too, so you know it's something that I think would be certainly worth looking into. Until I have the information to show that it would actually increase voter turnout, you know, I can't give you a definitive answer, but I'd absolutely look into it. Yes.
Next question.
Patricia Granger. San Diego State University is growing at an alarming rate and pushing into surrounding communities in place of building a satellite campus linked by a shuttle service. UCSD is said to have a cap of 30,000 students. The campus was planned not to grow beyond its boundaries. How would you, the mayoral candidates, regulate growth and encroachment into family neighborhoods adjacent to these respected universities? Thank you.
Who's the question for? Who is that directed at, please?
Donna Fry, please.
Oh. No, how would I? It's my lucky day. One of the things that we need to do is we need to make sure that the city actually complies with and respects the adopted community plans, which oftentimes doesn't happen. A lot of the issues that you're talking about deal with substantial conformance issues where people will say it substantially conforms to the adopted community plan, even though it doesn't, and it eliminates the public's ability to participate. So a couple of the ways to address that would be to make sure that there was, first of all, a public process so that the deals weren't cut behind the scenes before the public had an opportunity to participate, make sure that we actually comply with the adopted community plans, and make sure that we're doing the environmental analysis, that it is actually thorough, realistic, and sets reasonable mitigation measures.
Yeah. What about satellite campuses? Satellite campus. Instead of going beyond its boundaries, but having a separate campus in a less controversial area.
Oh, I think anything we can do to make you know, education directly in the community, to have satellite campuses, sure. As long, again, you need to make sure that whatever you're proposing is in compliance with the community plan or adopt some sort of mitigation measures in order to address whatever impacts might be, you know, be brought by that particular development.
Next question.
My name is Mike Binder. I'm a graduate student here at UCSD. My question is for Mr. Francis. I'm curious, we're talking a lot about the budget and everybody's talking about the problems, but in the private sector and in the real world, either you raise your income or you cut your spending. So what are some specific plans you have for actual service cuts or actual tax increases to help balance this?
Well, first off, I'm totally against tax increases because I think that if you give the city council any more money, that would be in itself would be irresponsible. And I've been very adamant about this. I'm not going to give this city council one red cent of additional revenue because they have proven not to be totally irresponsible with it. In fact, they have not been able to manage this process at all. And part of the problems that we have with the pension system is because they haven't been able to step up to the plate and control the spending. They took the money out of other programs and other things in order to fund their uncontrollable spending. As far as cutting programs are concerned, you know, what we need to do is a, and I talk about this in my plan, francisformayor.com, you go to my plan, and we need to do performance audits of every city department. We need to look for waste, we need to look for inefficiency, we need to look for duplication of services. And we also need to work with the county, for example. There's no reason why you should have two government entities doing the same thing. I'll give you one example in the time that I have left, is the library system, for example. There's no reason why you should have a county library system and a city library system. We can work with the county in order to save money by having one system rather than two systems.
I'd just like to add to that, because there was a tax component to the question. I agree with Steve, but beyond that, you know, we just saw in the paper today that the United States deficit was reduced by $100 million because of revenues that came in from a rising economy. Things are going well out there, and things are doing well. The tax cuts work, the budget's working, and the same thing can happen here in San Diego. If you have good management and good stewardship of what the city is, you'll see things are getting better. There is more money coming in by about 10% to the city alone, but if 10% comes in more taxes right now, they'll spend 11%. We've got to manage that.
The issue is that not there's only two options. It's not just raise revenue or cut services. It's cut costs. And as long as we're using our current government employees with the current contracts that they have, it was mentioned that the union members are happier. I bet they are. Their pensions are 2 to 5 times higher than people make doing the same jobs in the private sector. I'd be happy too. What's missed is their pay as well is 20 to 40% higher than the private sector. It used to be government jobs were low pay, but a nice pension and good job security. That has changed. So now we need to look at outsourcing or at least competitively bidding those areas. You'd be amazed that 8,000 of the 11,000 city jobs can be contracted out. That would save us $250 million a year. That's what we need to do, is deliver the services at a competitive price and not go to tax increases, fee increases, government issuing obligation bonds, or land sales. I'm opposed to all four of those. They're all appeasement. Thank you.
Ms. Fry?
One of the things that we need to do in order to get more revenues, ensure that the promises made are the promises that are kept. And one of the things, and I'm glad I had a chance to answer this, because the redevelopment money that all my colleagues seem to think is not available, and that somehow we should not get it back right now, is not looking at the facts. The environmental impact report for the downtown ballpark in the 26 block area, when they identified what the environmental impacts were, such as fire, police, parks, roads, schools, libraries, one of the mitigation measures requires that you identify the source of funding. The source of funding that was identified to pay for those services, because they're absorbed by our city's general fund, was the loans that the city had made to the redevelopment agencies. That was a promise. That promise should be kept. We should be getting at least $20 million a year back. The other thing we can do is we can reduce the amount of outside consultants and outside attorneys that we are paying exorbitant amounts of money. That would save us a lot of money.
Thank you.
I'd like to thank all the candidates for coming here to speak to our campus. Mr. Ryder, not every college student was at the beach today. A lot of us decided to come and listen.
Thank you.
This question is directed to Mr. Sanders.
Could you step up close to the mic? I can barely.
Given the large Native American community in San Diego, how would you personally involve the Native American perspective in your administration?
You know, one of the things that we did when I was on the police department was we reached out to every community in San Diego, and we went out to every community in San Diego. We went out to communities that were geographically based. We went out to communities that were interest-based. We went out to ethnic communities, and we asked them how they wanted to be policed. We also made sure that once we were told how they wanted to be policed, we met with them on a regular basis, so that we could give feedback on what we had done in the prior time of the scheduled meetings. And then we also asked them what they wanted us to do next. So we kept that contact with every community in San Diego. The second part of that is the only way you can reflect what San Diego looks like, whether it's Native American or any of the other communities, is by having representatives on city staff in high positions that represent and show the diversity of the city, so that when people come to access those services, the city looks like the people that are accessing them. And that's exactly what we did on the police department.
Yeah, I totally disagree with that, Jerry. But to answer your question, I want to look to what the tribes have done in California with the sovereignty, because we're constantly accused as people who own businesses of people who are just here to abuse our employees and take advantage of everything. We have all this redundant regulation in California. We have Cal OSHA as well as OSHA. We've got California Air Resources Board on the federal level. We have EPA. You guys are exempt from all that. And you know what? If you ask employees, the people that work at Verona and Power and all these other places love working there. You guys have done a great job.
Speak into
it. Going in and out. You need to give him the other mic that you just turned in. Is there a mic right over there?
Did you get the answer?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Schultz.
Thank you.
Okay, let's pass this one down and see if this works. Mike.
New mic. Ma'am, please.
Hi, my name is Kristen Johnson. I'm a UCSD staff employee. My question's for Donna Frey. We, as UCSD staff employees, we pay exorbitant amounts of money for parking, for the chance to get parking. And yet, if we live anywhere outside of TC, we have absolutely no other way of getting here. Do you have any plans for a trolley extension if you were to become mayor, or some other way to get here?
The trolley extension. Yes, I think it's a great idea. We just had the trolley extension out to San Diego State, and it works quite well. So the plans for that, I know that there was a trolley extension being proposed. Whether or not it came right to this campus, I'm not sure, but in the interim, because it would take an inordinate amount of time before that would occur, there's other ways to provide public transportation outside of a trolley, and you could actually have buses that picked you up where you live and brought you where you wanted to go. One of the problems we have with public transportation is it's not particularly friendly for a lot of the users to try and get you to the area that you need to get to. So that could be adjusted immediately. And yes, I would be working on that as the mayor.
Thank you. And just to comment on the busing that you just said, I actually live by San Diego State, and I looked it up. It would take me 2.5 hours to get here on a bus.
Yep.
So, no, thank you.
It's difficult, I know.
Thank you, Mr. Ryder.
We need to improve the transportation in the city, but trolleys are not the way to go. They're incredibly expensive. When you look who actually rides them, I know these opening ceremonies are wonderful, and it's like Disneyland. Everybody gets the free ride. Come back a week later. See who's riding. It's appalling. Not because the trolleys are totally inflexible. They're incredibly expensive. Cost $500 million for that trolley extension. How many buses could we be running? And how much more diverse could the delivery of people be to and from various places with $500 million? Trolleys are a terrible solution to transportation. We've wasted billions of dollars on them. Let's go other routes. The buses work great because they run on the rails we've already laid. That's roads. Thank you.
My name is Ernie Lippi. I'm a dentist here in San Diego and a two-time congressional candidate myself. My question concerning my property rights and concerns about them are directed at C. Francis and Pat Shea, who were quoted in the Union Tribune last week that when you stated that the new eminent domain ruling by the Supreme Court should be applied on a case-by-case basis, or have you recanted your opinion on confiscating private property for the transference of one person from one person to another? Have you changed your mind? Because tonight I believe you did mention something different than what you were quoted at.
Is that the Pat Shea or my?
Either
I'll go for actually, let's go ahead. Let's do it to Mr. Francis, because both of you agreed in the paper, and I just want to know if my personal property rights are going to be protected when we have a strong mayor in San Diego, or if it's possible that you might want to put a Marriott or some other hotel because of a broader tax base and replace our personal private home.
Yeah, I mean, I think in that particular case with the Marriott, it was inappropriate. And when I was quoted in the paper on a case-by-case basis, you have to take a look at each particular situation and evaluate whether by using the power of eminent domain that is used for a blighted area. And there's where it gets a little fuzzy. And that's why you have to look at it in a case-by-case basis, and you have to have rules around that. But just to be able to take property from one, Richard Ryder said earlier is correct. To take property from somebody so that somebody else can make more money, okay, in a non-blighted area, I think is not a good use of power, and that's not something that I support.
Then you do not support the Supreme Court ruling.
I think that the city needs to adopt rules around eminent domain and make sure that you apply those rules. And I think that the Supreme Court ruling was too broad. I do believe that. So I don't support it, no.
All right, thank you. So.
Mr. Shea?
The Supreme Court ruling was not with respect to the law in California, and it doesn't change the law in California, which is more restrictive than the Supreme Court ruling. So when your questioner asked me about the article in the newspaper, and the newspaper asked me the same question, I said, well, the California standard still applies, and that will be applied on a case-by-case basis. That's how it got translated into the press that way. But the California standard isn't the Supreme Court standard, and it's more restrictive than the Supreme Court standard, so I think you have a pretty good chance of being able to stay in your home for a little bit longer. Thanks.
Yeah, I just want to say the papers have done a great job, I think, in this campaign, but I know how many times I've been misquoted. I just suggest, you know, all of us have websites up and phone numbers. If you see something like that, I know I'd like you to call me and question me on it. I'm sure these guys feel the same way. I'm not blaming the papers and the magazines, but they report in the context and they're trying to condense. I mean, I talk a lot. They put it down to a sentence. It's kind of tough.
Last one.
Quick comment on that, and I think it's important. The California law and its definition of blight is exactly the blight findings that we've been using to eminent domain people right out of their businesses and allowing a private use to be given over to another private property owner. And it's wrong. And one of the definitions of blight under the California standard says if a parcel is irregularly shaped, you can essentially take it over. And I would tell you that every single one of us up here are irregularly shaped. and we're not going anywhere. So we need to change the standard under which the findings of blight are made, because they are so vague and they are so able to be interpreted any way anybody wants. And so it needs to be clarified and changed, because it's wrong what's happening right now. It's awful.
Okay.
My name is Travis Knowles, and I'm a UCSD graduate student. And my question is for Jerry Sanders, but I'd like to hear other candidates' thoughts if possible. A couple of weeks ago before Red Tide, I took a swim in Ocean Beach, and I got sick. What would you guys do as mayor to improve beach water quality?
Well, it's one of the big issues right now, and it's going to continue to be an issue, is we don't have the audits out for 2003-2004, so we've stopped all bonding. A big part of what the issue revolves around right now is replacing sewer and water pipes in the older infrastructure throughout the city, and we can't do that. The council's literally paralyzed. They've not been able to do that, and I think it's absolutely crucial that we get the ability to get those audits out, that we sit down and get the attorney-client privilege waived, that we get those audits out, we go back and improve the capability of bonding so that we can get those infrastructures projects back so we're not getting the sewage spills. We got the collection basins in the stormwater runoff so that we're not polluting the waters and the beaches that you're talking about.
Go ahead. We're going to try to get all these questions, and we've got 2 minutes left. Please, go ahead.
Hi, my name is David Koppel. I'm from San Diego, but I go to a different UC campus. This is for Mr. Francis. I'm a bit confused because some of your advertising says that you're CEO of AMN Healthcare, but are you currently CEO? And also, you claim not to be beholden to special interests and because you've poured over almost $1 million into your campaign. But isn't that in itself a special interest?
What a question. It's my advertising says that I have CEO experience. I answer your question about being a CEO currently. On May 7th, I became chairman of the board of AMN Healthcare. It's a company that I founded with my wife 20 years ago. I've been CEO of that company pretty much the entire time. I think my wife was CEO for the first couple of years. And I've been the CEO of a public company. We went public November 2001. It was an interesting time. We were the third company to go public after 9/11. So I believe my advertising, I know my advertising is correct, and we say that I was a CEO, but I did move on to the chairmanship position on May 7th. As far as myself, I guess I am a special interest myself, in a sense, that I am projecting out what my beliefs are. And my interests are the interests, and my special interest is the interest of the people of San Diego. That's my special interest. I want this city to be run properly. I want it to be run efficiently. I want it to be run in a way that we're all proud of. I want it to be a way where we deliver better services at a lower cost. If that's a special interest, that's my message. And if that's a special interest, so be it.
Thank you, Mr. Francis. Next.
Hi, my name is Linda Cawley. I'm a longtime resident of University City. I'm also the chair of the planning group for University City. And my question is for Donna Shy and Jerry Sanders. And it has to do with the fact that, I have to pick one? Well, you pick. Mm-hmm. How would you deal with the conflict of interest when it comes to appointing people to boards? And I'm talking about the Planning Commission, the CCDC, and the Port and Ethic Commissions.
What I would do and have done and will continue to do is actually comply with Charter Section 42 and make sure that appointments to boards and commissions actually represent the community. That hasn't been being done. The other thing I would do is actually continue to comply with Charter Section 225, which requires people to disclose whether or not they have an interest in the city and make sure that those documents are available to the public. And the easiest way to enforce the conflict of interest laws is when someone applies for a position to ask them to fully disclose. So it's very simple. I would just continue to do what I'm doing, however, make sure that it is better enforced.
Thank you.
Thanks. Last question.
Hello, my name is Ramesses Serban. I'm a graduate of the urban planning program here at UCSD, and my question has to do with affordable housing. This region's population is projected to increase substantially in the coming years, and there's also a dwindling supply of available land to build on. So I'd like to hear what you guys think about providing more affordable housing in the face of those two issues.
Pick a candidate.
Councilmember Fry, please.
One of the things that we are doing, we continue to do, is to make sure that we have an inclusionary housing ordinance. We right now have it in lieu fee. I think we could do a lot more than that. The size or design controlled units that would allow more density to occur in an existing area, that they would be smaller units. And the other thing that we are doing and continue to do is to make sure that there are better jobs created
and jobs that will actually allow people to be paid enough money so that they can afford to live in the community in which they work.
Thank the audience. Very good questions. Excellent questions. We've got some journalists out there, I think. Now it's time for the wrap statements from the candidates. 2 minutes. They'll have 2 minutes. And we'll, we should start with Mr. Francis, please.
Well, thank you all for being here and for listening to us. I know I enjoy it. I know that my fellow colleagues up here enjoy it as well as I've talked to them about it. You know, this is a very important time for San Diego. And my campaign is all about bringing a business approach to City Hall. That's what it's all about. And I know it can be done. And you have a lot of naysayers who say it can't be done. I've built a company the last 20 years from a kitchen table to a company that now has last year we had revenues of $630 million with nearly 7,000 employees. I know how to run an organization. And as we move toward being to the CEO form of government, it's very important that you have somebody in there who knows what it's like to be a CEO, knows what it's like to lead, and knows what it's like to apply business principles to an organization. And what we need to do in that government is two things. The two top priorities is, first off, to focus on this pension like a laser beam to get this thing solved. And we're going to do that by rolling back the pension benefits, and we're going to do that by freezing spending so that new tax revenues coming in go to the unfunded pension benefits. Liability. We're also going to do it by saving money, by reducing the size of government 8 to 10%. And that's where the business principles matter. We're going to do it by setting goals and objectives for the employees. We'll give the employees tools so they can rise up to those goals and objectives. We're going to, for those employees who can't meet and increase their productivity and reach those goals and objectives, we're going to ask them to leave. It's not going to be a city hall that is going to reward low producers. We have to do this. It's the right thing to do, but we also need to do it in order to raise the money, in order to pay for this irresponsible spending by our elected officials. We need to do performance audits of every single solidary department to wring out the waste, the fraud, duplication of services, and the inefficiencies. And we also need to do zero-based budgeting, in which the department heads come to the meetings with nothing, with zero, and they have to justify every position and every program.
That's it.
That's how you raise. That's how you run a government. That's what I will do as mayor of San Diego. Thank you very much for your time.
Shelby, you're it.
I'm it. Oh,
two is.
Sorry about that.
I'll get
him. Oh, you're going in your own.
He was mesmerized.
You know. I got to tell you, these are important forums, and it's a privilege to be here, up here, and up here with this crowd up here. Good people, all of them. This has got to be, I think, the most skeptical of forums that I've been in. And I mean, that's a good thing. It's important that you know you're skeptical, but you know what? You got to believe in something. You got to have belief, and you got to have faith. And if you don't have something to believe in, then that's sad. But this is a great country. It's a great city. We've got to focus on what works in this city. And we've got to have someone here that can provide the kind of leadership that gives the people of this city hope. And that's what I want to do. Look, I came from the projects in Brooklyn. I worked myself up. My dad drove a cab, worked in the luncheon, went to school, built the business. He died. I came back to New York, built something, took my family, my four kids, and brought them to what I think is the best place on earth. And it is that way. And boy, I want people to feel good about being in San Diego again. And that's what this candidacy is all about. Specifically, we need to do something about secure borders. No one's talking about it. We've got to do something about that. We can't ignore it. And there's a role that the mayor plays. I want to tell you something else. It's a nonpartisan job. So Democrats, Republicans, you have no representation in Sacramento. Someone's got to get up there and get those people to recognize that San Diego gets about 11 cents on every dollar we send up in taxes, and San Francisco gets 82 cents. They're using our money to pave their streets and fix their infrastructure, and someone's got to do it. I want to tell you, when it comes to the borders, when it comes to getting our money back from Sacramento, I'm going to go to Sacramento and shake those trees. I'm going to Washington, D.C. and shake the bushes. Thank you for your vote.
That was good.
That's a new one.
Hi, and when I'm mayor, I'm going to send Mike to do all that stuff for us, too. We didn't talk a lot about my issue, and a lot of the questions today and a lot of the campaign speeches you're going to hear are, in my opinion, politics as usual. It's about life as usual. It's about what we would do in our city if it was fiscally solvent, if it was operating correctly, what would be our ambitions, what are the places, how would we tweak it around the edges, and we're not there. That's not the city we live in. We live in San Diego. San Diego has a pension deficit of somewhere between $3 billion and $6 billion. It accrues interest at $20 million per month, of which the city puts aside nothing. That issue drives everything. All of our hopes, ambitions, all these issues, everything we talked about today, Mike's enthusiasm. If it wasn't for that, I wouldn't be in this race because I've been in structured finance my whole life. My wife, Diane Scipione, was on the pension board for seven years. So I'm here because I bring a different option. It's the Chapter 9 reorganization, which happened in Orange County. Orange County had a $2.3 billion deficit. 18 months later, it didn't have a $2.3 billion deficit. A lot of litigation to no litigation. No books, no audits to books and audits. There's a process you go through. It's an orderly process. You have to be a little grown up to go through it. You can't pretend like everything's just fine. But if you're ready to do that, there is a process you can go through. You can resolve all of your problems in one place. You bring everybody back to the table. They're compelled to come. This is the ride out. And if you want to do that, go on my website, read about me. I've done this before. I'll do it for you. I appreciate your support. I'd appreciate your vote. Thank you.
You know, I hope that the gift you've given us is $100 bills, because
I'll take yours.
What I think is really important is the exact theme that you hit upon, and that's how you get into office and how it's open and how people have an opportunity to participate in that process. I've participated by raising money in every community in San Diego, small amounts up to the limit of $300. I'm very proud of that. I haven't put amounts of money into it myself, and I don't intend to. I think it's really the community's way of saying who they support and how they want to be governed. 26 years on the San Diego Police Department, organization of literally 3,000 people, 1,200 volunteers at the time I was there, $220 million budget, tough decisions every single day. I was held responsible for those tough decisions every single day. I anticipate being held responsible for the decisions I make as mayor every single day, and I think that's absolutely fair and proper. I moved on after being chief of police for 6 years to United Way of San Diego County, restructured that organization, which had lost money for seven straight years, produced a 20% increase in contributions, reorganized that so that we lowered overhead, and then went to Red Cross, which was in little meltdown at the time, and reorganized that. What I'm telling you is strong leadership. I've given that. I've done that my entire career. I'm telling you I've had experience in turning troubled organizations around three times, big organizations. And finally, a record for transparency in those organizations, a reputation for honesty and integrity. That is exactly what San Diego needs right now to shake up what's going on, because we have a paralyzed council. We have no mayor after Friday. And it's time we start moving, and you need the leadership to do that. I'm the person that can provide that leadership.
City Attorney Mike Aguirre needs help. Agree or disagree, we needed a guy like Mike Aguirre to change the tone at City Council.
I like Mike. I'm basically a kinder, gentler version of Mike Aguirre. I've been fighting from the taxpayer standpoint for over 25 years. The Howard Jarvis Taxpayer Association has endorsed me. They said that I saved San Diegans more money than all the politicians we've elected in the last 20 years combined. It's what I do. Agree or disagree, you know what I'm going to do. And that's the point. You don't know exactly what we mean. If we mean what we say, Dick Murphy said one thing when he ran, he did something quite different when he got into office. I'm the hard nose in this race. I'm the guy the unions fear the most. I'm the guy who's going to go toe-to-toe with them and force them to make major concessions or lose their jobs. There is no other answer. Bankruptcy doesn't work. Orange County is right back in the hole. They now at this stage are facing an upwards of a $5 billion deficit because they did the same dumb thing we did here in San Diego. It's spreading to other communities as well. It's time we realize that we cannot let the unions run the city of San Diego. They do right now. Everyone that's been elected since 1998, Democrat and Republican, has been elected with the support of the labor unions. They own the city council, they've owned the mayors, and they've gotten their way. We can't afford what they got, and they're not going to give it back voluntarily. I put out 110,000 flyers. I've got 2,000 signs out. I've got a good group of volunteers walking precincts. We're doing everything we can to win this race. You got two elections, primary and general. I want your vote in the primary. Cast your ballot for someone who will vote in your favor when you get elected. If I don't get elected, I'll be the guy out there fighting the tax increases that these other people will be proposing. Thank you very much.
First of all, I want to thank the Common Cause. I want to thank the university. I just want to thank everybody for allowing us to come here tonight and speak to you. We appreciate it very much, and we appreciate your time. Most of you know me. I grew up in San Diego. I moved here in 1957, and I grew up here. I went to school here. I got married here. I started my business here. And I became an elected official here. And you know my voting record. You know that when I tell you something, that you can depend on that. And you know that despite the fact that many of the people here like to demonize the working class people because they happen to be members of unions, that I'm proud to be supported by the working class. I am part of the working class, and that's the grocery store clerks. It's our postal workers. It's the people that clean motel rooms. And it's also our city employees who clean our parks, who staff your libraries and your recreation centers. It's the police officers and the firefighters. So we need to keep that in mind, that they're also our neighbors. However, despite the fact that I have the support of the trade unions, not the city employees unions, I still know when something is wrong, and I still have the ability, as I've always had, to say no to my friends when I need to. And I have. And you know that. And you know that when you vote for me, that what you see is what you get, that I will tell you the truth. You know my voting record. You know you can rely upon my word. And you don't have to wonder if what I'm sitting here telling you tonight is honest or truthful, because I have a record that you can depend upon. Thank you so much, and I hope I receive your vote.
Let's give a hand to our panel and our candidates, if you could. And give yourselves a hand, because you, the audience, are the ones that are going to make a difference in this next election. Sitting before you, one of these people will be elected our mayor. You need to vote July 26th, and you need to keep your feet to the fire when they go in the office. Get involved. Stay active. I'd like to a change of mood just for a moment. We'd like to adjourn this meeting in the memory of longtime Common Cause leader Stan Ember. His wife Shirley's with us here. Thank you for coming. Good afternoon.